WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. It's Thursday, March 30th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. We've got a packed show today with breaking news on the financial front at the top. A little later, we're going to show an interview I conducted with senior editor Veronica Karolinko, who will be hosting a panel at the Better Way Conference in the UK. And we'll also look at the Educate Activate 1-2 punch that's key to restoring America. But first, in a deal announced yesterday, Brazil and China have agreed to ditch the US dollar and instead trade using each other's currency. China is destroying the last remnants of the Bretton Woods World Financial Order by ending the US dollar status as the world's reserve currency. This is by far the biggest step toward that goal thus far. China surpassed the US to become Brazil's top trading partner in 2009, and we are watching China take over Latin America without firing a shot. The communist regime is determined to impose a China-centered world order, and it's getting closer and closer to that goal. And the school shooting that happened in Nashville, Tennessee earlier this week is sparking controversy beyond the leftist cries for gun control that we normally hear after a tragedy like this. A group calling itself the Trans Resistance Network released a statement saying that the shooter, who police identified as transgender, is the real victim in the Christian elementary school shooting. They blame society's resistance to trans lunacy, saying that hate has consequences. Social media commentators are calling the statement a veiled threat. Others are crying false flag, and still others are asking that police release the manifesto that the Nashville police chief mentioned in a press conference following the shooting. Newsweek reported that LGBTQ groups are threatening serious consequences if police publish the manifesto. Their threats have prompted speculation that the shooter was motivated by anti-Christian bigotry. Here's Tucker Carlson's take on it.
We seem to be watching the rise of trans terrorism. The man who tried to murder Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh after the repeal of Roe v. Wade, identified as a, quote, trans gamer girl. The man who shot up a nightclub in Colorado in this past November and murdered five people, identified as non-binary. And now this. And there could be more. Antifa has announced this coming Saturday is the, quote, trans day of vengeance. Vengeance for what? That's not explained. But the suggestion is there will be violence in Washington this weekend. You're not supposed to talk about any of this, apparently. And the authorities in Nashville certainly are not planning to talk about it. They're doing their best not to. But somehow we can't see the manifesto in which the killer explains why she killed. Why is that? It's not accidental. Well, you know exactly why it is. Because it would make the obvious undeniable. The trans movement is targeting Christians, including with violence.
Though police have said they will not release the document until their investigation is over, social media users point out that officials still haven't released the motive despite having had the shooter's manifesto since the day of the tragedy. Steve Bannon and Jack Posobiec think we may never see it.
The local police told Mike, I talked to Michael Patrick Leahy out there in Nashville, the great Michael Patrick Leahy. He said that he went right to the police and said, we need to see the manifesto. And they said, well, the FBI took it. And I said, didn't they make a copy of it? The FBI did it not to disclose it. The FBI took it to bury it.
Look, Steve, this is the same FBI that we know has been making lists of churches working with disgraced and discredited groups like the SPLC, making lists of churches around this country that they view as a little bit too religious, a little bit too spiritual, making a list of people who pray the rosary, targeting people who go to the traditional Latin mass. This is the same FBI. And Steve, I'll tell you right now, if the FBI is involved, that's because they've opened a terrorism investigation.
Posobiec's last words, in case you couldn't hear them, were, if the FBI was involved, that's because they've opened a terrorism investigation. The Trans Day of Vengeance that Carlson mentioned was originally branded as a day of visibility. Libs of TikTok tweeted this activist trans rant.
If they try to arrest you or have you arrested on a felony for existing, beat them, team up, gang together, get people who agree with you to come and fight. Carry a weapon at all times. And yes, you have to attack the police officer.
Meanwhile, Amazon.com is making a killing on sales of t-shirts that read trans rights or else. and bear silhouettes of rifles in pink and light blue. And speaking of our world changing at breakneck speed, yesterday the Future of Life Institute issued an open letter signed by over 1,000 AI leaders, including Elon Musk, calling for a six-month pause on the development of AI technologies more powerful than GPT-4. The company OpenAI launched its GPT artificial intelligence model last fall as a free service. Since then, there's been a constant stream of articles about interesting interactions between GPT service and users. An improved version, GPT-4, was released online on March 14th. While tech experts warning about the existential threat of AI is not necessarily new, it looks like the warnings have become more frequent and more urgent as its capabilities improve. Mark Rotenberg, one of the signers of the letter, is the founder and director of the Center for AI and Digital Policy. He said his organization plans to file a complaint this week with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission calling for it to investigate OpenAI and ChatGPT and to ban upgrades to the technology until, quote, appropriate safeguards, unquote, are in place. According to this open letter, contemporary AI systems are now becoming human competitive at general tasks, and we must ask ourselves, should we let machines flood our information channels with propaganda and untruth? Should we automate away all the jobs, including the fulfilling ones? Should we develop non-human minds that might eventually outnumber, outsmart, obsolete, and replace us? Should we risk loss of control of our civilization? Unquote. Here are some dire warnings about AI from Elon Musk.
I'm really quite close to, I'm very close to the cutting edge in AI, and it scares the hell out of me. It's capable of vastly more than almost anyone knows, and the rate of improvement is exponential. We have to figure out some way to ensure that the advent of digital superintelligence is one which is symbiotic with humanity. I think that's the single biggest existential crisis that we face, and the most pressing one. I think the danger of AI is much greater than the danger of nuclear warheads, by a lot. Mark my words, AI is far more dangerous than nukes.
Join me to discuss today's story is the New American's executive senior editor, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Man, is our world changing fast.
It is. And, you know, one of the interesting things about it is that it seems like the most significant events are often the ones that are the least heralded, that people that are just not. I mean, for example, the story on the Brazil-China currency agreement,
yeah,
which pretty much surfaced late last night,
mm-hmm,
is almost absent from all the news platforms. So very few people have taken note of this. Similarly, you mentioned probably the central aspect of the Nashville shooting, the manifesto, the motivation,
right,
of the shooter is just sort of discreetly being, you know, nothing to see here, folks, move on. Let's talk about guns.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about school violence, and on and on and on. So it's just so often the case that, you know, that the really important events that are going to reverberate decades into the future are oftentimes unheralded and cast aside, which is why we need programs like this one, where we try to select the things that in our best judgment are really going to be significant, not necessarily the baubles and gaudy objects,
right,
that are focused on by the
shiny object.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that. I was actually thinking exactly that on the car ride over. And you had pointed the story out, and so as we were working on the script, I noticed that even the Wall Street Journal hasn't reported this, and that's kind of like, that's been their thing, right? So financial news, and this is big news, right?
Right. So let's unpack. Well, first of all, the problem with reporting on anything financial and economic is that everyone knows that this is considered to be boring,
yeah,
or, you know, above most people's heads, right? Okay. So the thing is, I'm a boring person to begin with. So I like boring stuff, and that includes finance and economics and so forth. But, you know, boring or not, it is absolutely crucial.
Boring or not, this is going to affect everyone watching.
So let's unpackage how. Okay. So the world order, the world financial and economic order that we have now is underpinned by the U.S. dollar. Okay, it's the world's reserve currency, It has been such since the end of World War II, pursuant to the Bretton Woods Agreement.
Right. Okay,
so a lot of people have heard of it, but really don't know what happened at Bretton Woods. And what Bretton Woods was, Bretton Woods is a place in New Hampshire near the White Mountains. Anyway, it was an agreement where the then, you know, world powers got together and said, okay, after World War II, we're going to fashion a new order of things, and that includes finance. Originally, there was an economist, a very famous economist named John Maynard Keynes, who kind of was the guy that was running the whole conference, and he wanted to set up a single global central bank issuing a single global currency, and he proposed to call it the Bancor. Well, at that time, this proposal didn't really fly because of, sovereignty concerns and so forth. So the fallback, compromise was, okay, we'll make the U.S. dollar the global currency, and the U.S. government and Federal Reserve, the issuers of that currency. And we're going to make sure that all world trade is denominated in dollars. So we'll have this simplified international system. Okay, and then there are other things that have happened since then, which we don't have time to discuss, like the closure of the gold window by Nixon in 1971 that had an effect. But the bottom line is this. We have had for many decades now a world financial order that benefits the United States disproportionately, because we control the world supply of dollars, and hence we have the ultimate say in the relative valuations of currencies and all goods, including really crucial goods like petroleum,
right,
that are traded internationally. Okay, it also means that we have this unique situation where if our government wants to print more money to inflate the dollar, so
no,
to speak,
they never want to do that.
Yeah, sure, to pay off things that they can't do by upfront taxation.
Which we've been doing for how long now? Decades?
Well, I mean, they have this unique release valve that the Argentinas and the Zimbabwes of the world don't have.
Yeah.
Okay, and that is we can always export some of that inflation.
Right.
Overseas, right?
Now that's going to be over.
Yeah, Argentina can't do that. They pursue, in many ways, policies very similar to our own, but nobody wants Argentine pesos. So if they print more money, it just manifests in the form of huge inflation, price inflation, right? So we've been able to avoid that by exporting it and spreading it out, through the world, okay? So the Chinese are very clever. They understand banking and finance very well. They've been a mercantile people for hundreds, thousands of years. In fact, they were the first country to discover the power of fiat paper money way back in, I believe, the Tang Dynasty was the first place, many centuries before the Europeans, the West, discovered this, what's been called the Mandrake mechanism. Okay, so they know how to do this stuff.
Yeah.
They know how to play this game, and right now they're playing it better than we are.
So, what does this mean for the average American?
Okay, well, what it's going to mean is this: if current trend lines continue, China is going to woo away a very large part of the world economy and persuade them to start accepting their currency, the yuan or the renminbi, it has a couple of names, instead of the dollar. Okay, so that's going to close off an avenue for us to export inflation, for one thing. And for another, it's going to
undercut. So does that mean things are going to get more expensive here? Inflation is, we're going to absorb that.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
But it also means that the Chinese will begin to do what the United States has been doing for decades, namely they're going to impose their set of rules on world trade. Okay, so, I mean, what we've had is a kind of a two-pronged, I hate to use the term world order, but sort of a global state of affairs since World War II, in which the United States military has dominated the world in the way that militaries do,
right?
Maintaining open seas and all this other stuff, okay? And obviously occasionally bombing countries and all the rest of that. So we've militarily dominated the world at the same time that we financially dominated the world. We've been a superpower in both respects. And China now is bidding fair to knock us off both of those pedestals.
Wow. Got a minute or two on the others. Any of those other stories really strike you? The shooter story doesn't seem to shock. It's not shocking at all. There is anti-Christian bigotry. That most likely will be the case. It seems like at this point it's still speculative, but highly likely. What about the AI? The AI one is another one of those things that I think Americans and people in general, they're not going to pay attention to, and it hits their lives, like COVID did. When COVID came down on us, people couldn't believe that the West could be so authoritarian, whereas we and several other organizations have been saying, look, there is in place a structure for the West to implement and to act authoritarian, and we saw that.
Well, I mean, as far as AI is concerned, I'm not an expert on AI, but what I've seen of ChatGPT and its various, instantiations over the last few months, it is shockingly competent compared to everything that's gone before. does this mean we're on the verge of a Skynet Terminator type, you know, takeover by the machines? I am skeptical because I think, I believe, and my decades of research into human cognition as a linguist, to me says that there's something about human cognition and
that
human consciousness
be replicated.
That can't be replicated by machines, at least by computers as we currently understand them to be.
Well, and that's my hunch, and I have no expertise or anything other than just a hunch, because I believe that God's design cannot be replicated. I spoke to someone who worked for Monsanto once, and he explained to me that Monsanto spent decades trying to replicate regarding crops and things like that, exactly what nature or God had done, and they couldn't. They just couldn't. And that was his argument for, he didn't know a whole lot about AI either, but that was his argument for saying, I'm not as terrified of this as, you know, some may be. Now, obviously, Elon Musk is.
I think the major danger, and maybe, I mean, we don't have enough context from what Musk was saying, but I'm not sure the danger is so much that we're looking, staring into the abyss of a
robot revolution.
A robot revolution, you know, a Matrix-type future something, you know, where the machines take over. I think that will remain the stuff of science fiction. I think the potential, though, of AI for other forms of human-directed control and deception and manipulation is very great.
Right, and that, like they were saying, I think another danger is that they're going to take away meaning, perhaps, or jobs or tasks, even fulfilling ones. Because I don't think anyone's worried. You know, you hear about it, it's like, oh, I'm so ticked off that I have to self-checkout at Walmart. It's like, really? It was that, like, you know, are we really taking away meaning from people because they can't be checkout at Walmart? But no, there are fulfilling ones. You know, we write, and now they're writing. And it's like, ooh, I like writing. Writing is nice, and it helps me communicate, and there's something fulfilling about it. So anyway, let's look at our final two stories. On Wednesday, the United Nations General Assembly voted to adopt what is being hailed as a landmark resolution on climate justice. The so-called ICJ resolution, named after the International Court of Justice, was spearheaded by the Pacific nation of Vanuatu and co-sponsored by more than 120 countries, including the UK. This is the latest attempt to coerce developed countries into forking over piles of money to poor countries in the name of climate justice. These kinds of loss and damage payments were first formalized in last year's COP27 conference, but without specifics on enforcement. Those pushing this latest UN resolution are hoping that the World Court will create additional legal scaffolding for loss and damage payments and other punitive climate measures. Some are even talking about defining a new class of crime, ecocide, or killing the climate. And is the Manhattan District Attorney's weak case against Donald Trump dead in the water? Fox News reported yesterday that a court administration source told the network that the Manhattan grand jury will meet next Monday and Wednesday, but it isn't expected to meet on the Trump investigation. The grand jury will then take a weeks-long break and not revisit the Trump case until April 24th. Back on March 18th, Trump posted on his Truth Social website that leaks from the district attorney's office indicated that he would be arrested the following Tuesday. The DA's office didn't deny this, and multiple cities around the country bolstered police presence in anticipation of civil unrest. But Trump wasn't arrested, and since then, grand jury meetings have been called off multiple times. There have been reports of major dissension in the DA's office and that the district attorney is having trouble convincing the grand jury to support the charges. Trump's accused of paying hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels to cover up an affair he and Daniels deny ever happened. And the DA's star witness in the case, Michael Avenatti, is a sleazy lawyer who's been convicted on multiple criminal counts, including extortion and fraud. And that's it for this segment. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And if you haven't already, subscribe to our biweekly robust print news magazine. You can do so at thenewamerican.com or by calling our office at 800-727-8783. That's 800-727-8783. And we'll be right back.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find. but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. Here's my interview with the New American's Veronica Karolinko about her upcoming participation in the Better Way Conference in the United Kingdom in June. Presented by the World Conference for Health, the conference will be looking at a better way for health, freedom, and sovereignty. Let's watch. Senior editor for the New American magazine, Veronica Karolinko, recently learned that she is hosting the Better Way Conference in Bath, UK, which begins June 2nd. The theme of the conference is Unveiling a Better Way for Health, Freedom, and Sovereignty. And joining us to discuss this exciting development is Veronica. Hey, Veronica.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you very much. This is really exciting.
Well, why don't you tell us a bit about this? What is this this conference, and what makes it so exciting?
Paul, it's really exciting. I'm really excited to be.
Are you excited? I can't tell.
one of the panels, not the whole conference, but just one of the panel discussions organized by the World Council for Health, which is a very reputable international organization. As you said, it will take place in Great Britain, in Bath, from June 2nd to 4th. And as you know, Paul, we really need to talk about the World Council for Health first, just a couple of words so people understand who they are and what they believe in. So, you know, during this past couple of crazy years, the New American has developed meaningful connections and built alliances with scientists and physicians who were smart enough to see that pandemic policies did not do any good and who were brave enough to speak out about it. So despite having, impeccable credentials and lifelong careers in their fields, those people found themselves censored and deplatformed. And as an honest, fact-driven, and freedom-loving media outlet, the New American became a platform for these voices, and Dr. Tess Laurie is one of them. As you know, she played a major role in promoting ivermectin as an early treatment for COVID in Great Britain, but her work is not limited to that. Back in September of 2021, she co-founded the World Council for Health, which quickly evolved from a local organization into a global coalition of health advocates, doctors, innovators, journalists, and activists from 45 countries. And here in America, for example, they partner with Children's Health Defense, led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, led by Drs. Pierre Corey and Paul Merrick. The New American interviewed many of them, including Tess Laurie herself, of course, and other members of the steering committee of the World Council for Health. And, you know, Dr. Laurie won me and so many other people with her integrity. You know, she's called the conscience of medicine for a good reason, and also with her philosophy of the better way. One of the most recent interviews that I did with her last year was about the very sensitive topic of vaccine injured and bereaved people. And Dr. Laurie helped organize hearings in the UK Parliament that hosted families and individuals who took one for the team and ended up injured or dead. And every person injured by a COVID shot is a pariah and the ghost for the government. And since the vaccines are still experimental in many countries, there's virtually no way for legal recourse. I asked about what people can do to fight back against this injustice. And she said something very insightful. She said that just fighting won't do much good. And we need to create and build a better way for health, freedom, and sovereignty to prevent any future injustices. And this is what they're working on. And I'm humbled to be a part of it.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. So obviously this came as a response to, well, as many things have come as a response to those 2 to 3 years of complete tyranny, much of which we are still, there's still much residue, if not just straight up leftover tyranny left over. It's nice to see this happening in the UK. I live in the woods in Wisconsin. I don't have a whole lot of connection to what happens there. But it would you say that Europeans, is this mostly European, or I'm sure there's Americans, but it's nice to see that the Europeans are pushing back too. Are you, you've done, like you said, interviews with Tess Laurie and so many of those who are in the front lines of the medical freedom movement. What kind of topics, apparently health, sovereignty, or those, what kind of topics specifically, and who specifically, in addition to obviously the founder, Tess Laurie, is going to be there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, the World Council for Health and many doctors and activists and journalists who are located in Europe encountered this tyranny probably even worse than we did here in America. It was so much more tough. So they recognize that the existing global system of governance, healthcare, media, and major corporations, particularly big tech and big pharma, have a very malevolent agenda. And so the council is trying to work out alternatives and workable solutions that people and communities could use. And this is reflected in the topics of panel discussions. There will be a total of nine of such discussions. And by the way, people can purchase tickets to watch them online if traveling to Bath, UK is not in the plans. But why not? You can watch online, and the tickets are available at betterwayconference.org. This is their website. Mm-hmm. So yeah, well, there will be a couple of, like I said, nine topics. So let me
pull them up.
They're right there. So from big pharma to real health, from fake foods to food as medicine, from AI and transhumanism to being human, from electrosmog, that is electromagnetic radiation, to nature's frequencies, from climate change to nature nurture, from thought control to free thought, from one health to our health. That's a reference to One Health approach proposed by the World Council, World Health Organization, that seeks to eliminate national sovereignty and treat all people on Earth using the same homicidal methods. And finally, from scarcity to abundance. So basically, the council is building a parallel system on the basis of certain values and principles. And those include, for example, a recognition that we all people on Earth, have free will and bear responsibility for our actions and inactions. All of their values and ideas are described on worldcouncilforhealth.org. And let me give you an example how it works, this parallel system. For example, the first panel discussion is themed from big pharma to real health. So during the pandemic, many woke up to the reality that large pharmaceutical companies are profit-driven and don't mind releasing poorly tested drugs with terrible and lasting side effects on people.
They just discovered this?
many people did trust big pharma. If you're sick, you go and you take a pill, or you go and you take a vaccine, or you go and give your child seven shots when they are born. People still do trust them, and this is really insane. But we do not need to stick this approach, you know. There are cheap and available repurposed drugs, for example, and non-medical interventions such as proper diet or fasting, you know, that really work against all sorts of diseases, including cancer. Now, I know it sounds like voodoo magic and something unscientific, but these approaches work. And I'm not saying that someone should not go to the hospital if they're sick, and you know, do not use the prescribed medications. But what's important here is that often patients are not given any other options except those approved by the federal agencies that serve big pharma.
Yeah.
Well, so this is what it's about. Yeah.
I don't think that sounds like voodoo at all. Back in my reporting days, I used to report a lot on farmers and things like that. There was one farmer in particular who, you know, he studied at UC Davis, and he was also doing studies. He was doing laboratory work in Italy because they were doing stuff that I guess they weren't allowed here. And it wasn't illegal stuff. It wasn't bad stuff. It was actually food. And he, and I still remember this because he said, because I would tell him, it's like the food, you know, he raised organic foods. And one of his things, his shticks was always, if people simply just ate good food, that would eliminate a lot of the problems that we're having. And I would look at foods, at organic foods and things like that. And I would tell him, it's like, man, that stuff is really expensive. And he said, how expensive it is nowhere near what it costs people normally in their medical bills and to their health. And ever since, and I don't know if exactly that, but then I got married and anyway, and my wife started gardening and we started eating better. And now I'm at a point where I can't eat fast food because it makes me nauseous, but I feel better. I think better when I, so that's not crazy. Those are age old wisdoms, right? I mean, you eat good food and you won't get as sick, right?
Yes, exactly right. And it applies to all other, aspects of human life, like exercising and just living healthy life, living a purposeful life, having meaning in life. It helps a lot.
One
of the principles of the World Council for Health, they say we're spiritual beings. We're not just bodies with bones and meat. We need to have a purpose in life. This is what makes us happy besides living healthy lifestyles. This Thursday I interview Dr. Tess Lori, and we will discuss the conference in more detail. So I really encourage our viewers to go to The New Americans and keep an eye on our interviews.
So who else is speaking or is giving presentations at this conference?
Yeah, there are a couple of confirmed speakers. For example, Dr. Pierre Corey will be there of the COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. I know that Professor Matthias Desmet, who is the author of, well, he's not
the psychology
an author. He's
of totalitarianism.
Yeah, exactly. He one of the most prominent theorists of mass psychosis. Mm-hmm. I know that many others, all people on the steering committee, Dr. Christoph Bloth of Germany will be there, Dr. Mark Trossi of Canada, Canadians suffered a lot from medical tyranny imposed on them. So many, many good people. Please go to thebetterwayconference.org. They are updating speakers on a daily basis.
Oh, okay. Now, you have covered this stuff extensively, and you've talked to, again, some of the biggest names in medical freedom. What is your take? You got a pretty good pulse on where it was, where it's going, and things like that. What is your take on this? Because it sounds like, you know, you said they looking to build a parallel world or universe, parallel world to the craziness. But I bet you that if this thing turns out, like if people step up, it won't be the parallel. I bet you it'll be the dominant reality, because those are things that all people want, right? Like individual liberty, to be healthy, to not be told by government where and when you can go, to depend on government and things like that. So I hear a lot of this too, this parallel government, including from the founder of Gab, Andrew Torba, he talks about it. But my guess is, if this parallel world is built, this parallel economy and all this thing, everybody's going to jump on board. And then you'll just, who's going to be like nobody wants to live the kind of life that the engineers of the one world, new world government want. Would you agree? Well, you don't have to agree that everyone's going to jump on board. I just want to.
Yeah, Matthias Desmet says that at least a third of all people will always comply with the government, no matter how ridiculous these dictates, no matter how much freedom they have to give up, no matter what happens to them personally, because they will always believe the authority. But Two-thirds is a majority, right?
Two-thirds is good. That's good.
It's a super majority. So yes, Paul, I really feel very optimistic, and just being with these people in the same room and sharing the stage and just listening to them, I think it just gives so much hope for the future.
Yes, yes, I agree. Whenever I hear these folks, you know, you've interviewed, for instance, Robert Malone, Dr. Robert Malone, a lot. And I had the pleasure of meeting him. And I asked him the same question when I met him. It's like, what is happening? He travels a lot. He sees this. And despite what we may see in mainstream media and even amongst in other aspects of life, I think there's definitely reason to be optimistic. And it's thanks in large part to the fact that a lot of people have taken a leading role, and now everyone's going to get more courage to follow along. Thank you so much, Veronica, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Paul.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.
Next up is our newest in a series of episodes about principles. Today's principle, the worth of the individual.
Hi, everybody. This is Gary Benoit, and today we have with us Steve Bonta, Executive Senior Editor of the New American Magazine, for our discussion of principles. Steve, welcome to the program once again.
Hi, Gary. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, very welcome. And today, I understand you'd like to talk about the worth of the individual.
I would. And again, this is another very basic bedrock principle. Mm-hmm. It kind of grows out of the other principles we've talked about that we often take for granted, and we sort of assume that everybody else in this 7 billion odd population of ours across the planet mm-hmm. more or less shares the same assumption. But that's not true.
Right. And of course, you have lived in other parts of the world, and including the non-Western world, such as China and yeah. India and Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in those cultures, all of their considerable, impressive achievements notwithstanding, one of the first things that you notice is the relative devaluation, in some cases even degradation, of individuality. This notion that individuals are strictly subordinate to the collective. That's not just something that comes out of, you know, modern communism or socialism. Right. We tend to think, when we think of collectivism, we think of, you know, political theory on the left mm-hmm. the last couple hundred years. But in fact, collectivism is a very old ethos. It's akin to tribalism at the very most rudimentary form. And one finds it also in Eastern religions. So, for example, and I don't mean to traduce people of different religious beliefs, but I just wanted to point out that the concepts of nirvana and moksha that people who've maybe studied a little bit of Buddhism and Hinduism are familiar with basically postulate that the end, the aim of this life and successive lives, believing in, you know, reincarnation of some sort, is to arrive at the point where the individual, with all of its desires and cravings, achieves moksha, which is release. In essence, from individuality and returns to the state of nirvana, or merging with sort of the universal collective soul, right? And so, yes. For a Buddhist, for example, the Buddha himself is conceived to be in such a state, which is why Buddhists don't pray to the Buddha, right? Because by definition, he's no longer an individual, you know, responsive entity. He's in a state of nirvana. Absolute cosmic collective bliss. And the importance of these sorts of ideas, these cosmological ideas, can't be understated, because in contrast with this, in Western religion, Judeo-Christianity in particular, we see the notion of one God. Hmm? Mm-hmm. And so if you think of God as being one, in one sense, right. That there are variations on the theme, but the basic idea is that you have one God or a single Godhead or something of that sort. And so that enforces the idea that somehow individuality is eternal because it's an attribute of God himself. And so it becomes then easier to believe in, well, you know, you and I and Gary, we're all distinct individuals. We live our lives. We make individual choices. And then individually, we, after death, go on to heaven or hell or wherever we go to, right? Mm-hmm. But that individual, that condition of individuality persists. Why is this important outside of a theology seminar? Because individuality is absolutely integral to the broader scheme of political thought and philosophy in which this country was founded, right? Because if you don't have individuals, you can't have individual rights. And if the individual is not important and sovereign for the most part, then there's no reason to create a limited government whose primary aim is to protect the individual. So those kinds of ideas outside of the compass of Western civilization tend to not get as much traction because the response is, well, you know, people think of themselves as, yeah, I guess in a way I'm an individual, but, you know, the most important thing is the tribe,
right,
or the village or the sodality or the party in the case of, you know, a communist type of arrangement. Right.
Right. Now, you referred to the compass of Western civilization, and that compass has really been set by Christianity. In fact, you really cannot talk about the history of Western civilization without talking about Christianity. And Christianity is very different from these Eastern religions because Christianity views a loving God, you know, a God who gave us an eternal soul, who gave us this individuality, made every one of us unique, and made every one of us in the image and likeness of himself. Mm-hmm. And so that really makes human life sacrosanct. But that respect for life and that respect for the individual really does not exist to the same degree in the Eastern world because they do not have that compass of Western civilization that was set by Christianity.
Yes, well, I mean, how can I say this? I think if, and I've actually done quite a bit of research mm-hmm. on this. First of all, if you look at the word culture, mm-hmm. it comes from the Latin word cultus, which originally meant, well, of course, the cult of a particular god. Now, the word cult today is this very freighted term that mm-hmm. makes us think of, you know, compounds and mm-hmm. extremists and people who commit mass suicide and all that sort of thing. It's become a very, you know, if you brand any religion a cult, you're insulting it. But the original meaning of the word was more or less coextensive with what we understand religion to be today. Now, why is it associated with culture? Because I think we understand intuitively that culture comes from cult or from cultus, from religion. Mm-hmm. You can't dissociate the two. And so, for example, you know, if you all cultures, I mean, why do we do things like write books or create governments or build buildings or compose poetry or other works of art? It's in some sense because we have this idea of you know, we want to create something enduring and permanent. We know mm-hmm. that this world is you know, is perhaps falling and imperfect and finite above all else. But to the extent that any religious system invests its believers in a sense that of this greater cosmos, right, that there's mm-hmm. a life beyond this one, that there's a heaven, that there is a god or perhaps gods, you know, if you come from a polytheistic, but it invests meaning into all of this. And
right.
so all cultures, whether consciously or subconsciously, mirror these first principles or first assumptions that arise from religion. And individuality is one of those, or lack thereof. You know, so whether you exalt the individual or the collective, always seems to depend in the first instance on these deeply held cosmological assumptions about the nature of God and the afterlife and the universe and heaven and hell and all of these things, right? And then we tend to model our culture and our behavior and of course our government after it. It wasn't so long ago that almost it was a given that the government was authorized by God, right? Mm-hmm. And that and I'm talking now with the divine right of kings and all that sort of thing, right? The people said, well, government is authorized by God, and the emperor or the king is basically his regent on earth, and whatever he says goes, and after the emperor or king died, he would be deified and would become part of the pantheon, right? So it's only been comparatively recent that we've tried to sort of dissociate these two and say, well, you know, this earth and this government and society are one thing, and religion is something else.
Right.
Right, but even though we legally separate church and state or religion and state, as the case may be, to a certain degree, appropriately so. We can never get away from the reality that the state and society are always going to be immersed
in this larger
religious worldview.
Yeah. Obviously, a total separation would be a very bad thing because in order for a government to be a proper government, it does need to be based on the laws of God.
It does.
And obviously, the closer that government acts in terms of acting within the framework of the laws of God, the better that government would be. And of course, today we have a constitutional republic in the United States, a unique system of government that was created by our founding fathers for the purpose of having a government that protects those God-given rights. But if you look back in history where you didn't have such a government, you might have had a monarchy, for example. And it might have been a Catholic monarchy or perhaps a Protestant monarchy. But, you know, if the monarchy was bound by tradition and bound by an understanding of the government and its laws, and if the monarchy was small and not to an extent where it could become tyrannical, you know, I'm not saying we should have monarchy today, but I think obviously that was better than what followed in terms of the absolute power of communism that was completely unrestrained, that did not follow the laws of God whatsoever. In fact, that shook a fist at the laws of God.
Yes. Well, I mean, it has been observed that if you could guarantee a good king, mm-hmm. monarchy would actually be the best form of government because most of us don't want to get involved. We have better things to do than be immersed in politics all the time, right? I mean, we want to do productive things. Mm-hmm. We want to be with our family. We might have hobbies and interests and everything. And politics can become all-consuming.
Sure. What happens when you get a bad king?
Right. So if you have a good king mm-hmm. who takes care of all that and mm-hmm. maintains the minimum government, you know, that sort of thing, then you've got a good deal. And that has happened a few times. Certainly in Anglo-Saxon history, and England has had, had some good kings. The problem is, as you say, that experience has borne out that there's no known system whereby you can guarantee a good king.
That's
the problem.
And
one
certainly
bad
what
king,
we have with a constitutional republic could be viewed as, in a sense, a form of mixed government, mm-hmm. where the president, whose powers are very limited, could be viewed as analogous to a monarch. Mm. The House of Representatives could be viewed as analogous to democracy or the people. And the Senate, the upper branch of government, could be viewed as kind of an aristocracy, a group of statesmen.
Yes. Yes, well, I mean, this is a point that that Hamilton made in the Federalist mm-hmm. Papers. He said, people look at, they're suspicious of this office of the president that we've created, and they rightly observe that it does resemble, in some respects, the British monarch. But his words were, as nearly as I can recall, that it resembles it in surface appearance, but in substance, his powers are much less.
Oh, yes.
So, for example, our president, unlike all old world monarchs, doesn't have, or at least at one time, and certainly constitutionally, still does not have the power to just declare war at whim or to levy taxes and this kind of thing.
Right. But certainly we have a government that is based on protecting the laws of God, and based on a recognition of the importance of the individual.
And that's the whole point of it. Mm-hmm. The whole point in the end, why would we go to the trouble of dismantling the monarchical system that we enjoyed, mm-hmm. I use the term advisedly, mm-hmm. under the British, and go to the trouble of setting up something new, something that is admittedly a risk and certainly experimental to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. We still don't know how this story is going to end. And the reason is that the founding fathers and also their ideological predecessors in Europe, the John Lockes and the Algernon Sidneys and so forth, who envisioned but were never able to accomplish it in the old world, because they said we need to do something to maximize individual human potential and liberty.
Right.
That's the point of it. But that doesn't mean anything if the individual means nothing.
And as a consequence, we've had the greatest experiment in this country in the history of human liberty. Steve, thank you so much, and can't wait to talk to you again next week.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, We remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
First educate, then activate. That is a strategy for saving America that the John Birch Society's Robert Owens recommends in his Constitution Corner program. Let's watch.
Hello and welcome to Constitution Corner. I'm your host, Robert Owens. The John Birch Society founder, Robert Welch, developed a victory strategy for America. And that strategy has an amazing track record of success that continues to today. Now, before we begin, if you appreciate this video, please like and subscribe to our channel and share this content, as that minimal effort helps us in spreading our plan for restoration of America. The Council on Foreign Relations is a globalist organization that infiltrates both political parties for the purpose of destroying American sovereignty and severely reducing the standard of living we have come to expect. Such a statement would have been somewhat controversial in most political discussion 10 or 15 years ago, but that is no longer the case. Now, what is the John Birch Society victory plan? Well, it's this. First, we must get educated. Second, we must get active. Now, this may seem simple, but there's a reason nation after nation has fallen completely into the grasp of the globalists. If the United States isn't careful, we will be next. Understanding constitutionalism and globalism is key in today's political world. In The Art of War, Chinese master tactician Sun Tzu teaches, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. If you know yourself but not the enemy, for every victory gained, you will also suffer defeat. If you know neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle. It is precisely for this reason that we must understand the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And by understand, I mean understand them at the fundamental level. Now, it's quite simple. Government does not give rights. Only God is the author of rights. The function of government is nothing more than the creation of political protection for those God-given rights. We must understand that the federal government has limited and enumerated powers, and if the federal government is not expressly granted a power, they're prohibited from acting in that area. For example, where in the Constitution is there any authority for the federal government to take your money and give it to a dictator from another country? Yet both Biden and Congress have acted unconstitutionally when they send Biden over to shovel your tax dollars into Zelensky's pockets. And they are not the only ones to blame. If we, the constituents, don't demand strict adherence to the Constitution from our elected officials, well, then we can't really complain when our president acts as if he is the king. Here's the solution. First, again, we need to educate ourselves. And again, I'm not talking about getting educated just as to the political realities of the world. I'm talking about knowing the practical application of those political realities. What I mean by this is that you need to learn how public policy is implemented in your local community and then your state. You need to understand the rules, and you need to understand how to organize. Another huge part of all this is that you have to build a team. Back when our founders were fighting the War of Independence, they succeeded because of their efforts in educating and organizing. First, they formed educational arm with organizations like the Committees on Correspondence, and then they formed an action arm called the Sons of Liberty. Their core concept was simple: educate first, then activate. No one person can defeat the globalists on their own, and no one person can win this fight if they do not understand the Constitution and how the globalists work. The John Birch Society has the premier tools that you can rely upon to get educated about the Constitution, to get educated about globalism, and to learn how to build a team to deal with it. Not only will we teach you how to build a team, we have full-time professional field officers around the country to support the growth and development of your team. America, you really don't have an excuse. Now, what does getting active look like? It looks like influencing opinion molders to such an extent that radical shifts in political leadership occur. The end result is dedication to Americanism over party loyalty. And a perfect example of this happened this past weekend in Michigan. Thousands of delegates from all over the state gathered for the Michigan GOP state convention to choose party leadership. Now, to be clear, the John Birch Society is nonpartisan and does not endorse candidates. As past JBS President Jack McManus was fond of saying, our members are so well-educated, they don't need anyone to tell them how to vote. However, the high political IQ of JBS members and leaders often places them in positions of great influence. And in these roles, they use the pro-American, constitutionalist agenda of the John Birch Society to guide their approach to public policy implementation. And this is how education leads to effective action. At the Michigan GOP State Convention, there was a lot of discussion on the floor about globalist influence in Republican politics and world affairs. Establishment favoritism clearly was not going to be allowed. This was evident when the convention put up a video of Donald Trump, who had endorsed the establishment-favored candidate. Because of this endorsement, Trump was loudly booed by thousands of Republicans as they were wearing Trump hats. In the end, the constitutional warrior with full knowledge of the globalist enemy was elected chairwoman, while the neoconservative wing of the Michigan Party was ripped out by the root, not one vestige remaining. In 1958, Robert Welch argued that when a sufficient number of Americans understood the nature of the globalist oligarchical conspiracy that seeks to destroy our heritage of liberty and enslave our people, patriots would begin to rout the satanic conspiracy that has plagued our nation. Due in no insignificant part to the hard work and sacrifice of John Birch Society members over the last 65 years, that goal is closer than ever to realization in 2023. Perhaps it is no coincidence that just after a revival to Christ was taking place in Asbury, a political revival to the Constitution was underway in Michigan. Don't just know your Constitution, live it.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and come back tomorrow when we discuss conspiracy theories. Enjoy the rest of your day.